Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Nishant, and welcome to another episode of the Nishant Garg Show. The mission of the show is to spread awareness on mindfulness practices, psychology, mental health, and spirituality. My job on the show is to invite world-class performers to share the practices to live a fulfilled life. Today's guest is Dr. Raquel. Dr. Raquel is the president and founder of Revitalize Project. As a speaker and thought leader, she has delivered inspirational and valuable health, performance, and leadership content to thousands of high performers in the areas of business and sports in over 25 countries. Dr. Raquel recently served as an assistant professor at New Mexico State University and as the wellness specialist for Cooperative Extension for the state. In this episode, Dr. Raquel discusses how to forgive people, developing resiliency, wellness pillars, managing stress, overcoming negative thoughts, and how to live a meaningful life. To know more, keep listening. Dr. Raquel, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Nishan. It's great to be here with you.
I'm thrilled to have you. I would like to start with something very simple. How does your family describe what you do for a living?
Well, I guess if you're asking my youngest child, he would say that I get on airplanes and I fly around and talk to people and get paid to talk, is what he would say. And if you ask my older child or my husband, they would say that I travel around and help people to make changes in their lives by inspiring them and giving them information that's useful to them.
What kind of talks do you give?
I give talks on well-being, resilience, neuroscience of wellness, behavior change. It's mostly in the wellness arena, but it overlaps with engagement, performance, and resilience.
Information, performance, and resilience. I would like to come back to this topic.
Okay.
And before that, I would like to ask you, could you tell us about your childhood and where did you grow up?
Sure. I was born in Chicago. My mom is from Cuba. My dad is from Uruguay. And I basically grew up most of my life in southern Florida. And I had a pretty, I guess, typical childhood there, and went to school at University of Florida in Florida, and then ventured outside of Florida to Texas A&M to do my master's. I worked in Texas for a while, and then I moved to Atlanta, Georgia, and then moved back to Florida in Orlando and worked there for many years before moving to where I am now in Las Cruces, New Mexico.
What did you study in college?
My bachelor's is in nutrition. My master's is also in nutrition. I'm a registered dietitian. And then my doctorate, which I went back for at the age of 40, that's what I called my midlife crisis, was getting my doctorate. I did it in health sciences with a concentration in global health, and really focused on the notion of what influences people's behaviors from a well-being and health perspective, culturally speaking, environmentally, just everything. And then how can you help people to make changes that they either need to make or want to make to be healthy?
How is nutrition related to well-being?
Yeah, so nutrition, you know, it depends on how you look at it. I, of course, think nutrition is a huge component of well-being. It's basically chemistry going on. You eat food and it has chemical responses and reactions within the system, and that affects all of your body. It affects your brain. I'm very interested in the gut microbiome. I do some presentations on that, and our gut bacteria, which is also influenced by what we eat, influences so many health conditions and diseases and even our brain, because the gut is connected to the brain. It's called the second brain.
Then how should somebody start working on their well-being? As a listener, I'm thinking, I don't know what to do, where to start from. What should I do, Dr. Raquel?
Yeah, it could seem overwhelming. You know, there's so many facets, I think, to well-being. The first thing that I do with people is I have them reflect on the purpose of their life, what matters to them, who matters to them, what they want to get out of life, because I think this really informs you as to what it is that you need to be working on and doing. So if I envision the purpose of my life, then maybe I can see how eating healthy might fit into that, or being fit and doing exercise might fit into that, or getting enough sleep, maybe reflecting upon how I manage my emotions, which then might involve mindfulness practices and other strategies to become more aware and be able to manage your emotions. It could be things around my mind. A lot of times I talk about thoughts. Thoughts are really the core of who you become. And so maybe it's about listening to your thoughts and then really assessing if those thoughts are aligned with your purpose and really constructively taking you where you want to go. And if not, there's a chance to change those thoughts. So I would say it's starting with purpose, reflecting upon where you are really, and then starting to make changes in the areas that you think maybe have the biggest conflicts or maybe are your biggest obstacles.
Is it possible that somebody has a bigger grand vision or purpose in their life, but eating healthy doesn't fit in that?
It's certainly possible. I mean, that happens all the time. I think there are so many people with lovely purposes. They're so connected to it, and yet they don't necessarily not just eat healthy, but maybe they don't take care of themselves. And, you know, again, I'm a behavior kind of expert, so I could, you know, name to you a bunch of things that could be going on that would, yeah, as well. It's, you know, so many factors. It could be, you know, their cultural influences, belief systems, memories and experiences, priorities. I mean, there are all kinds of competing things. And, you know, you can't do everything perfectly in every single facet of your life and do that sustainably. It's really hard, you know? So like, I might be really good at taking care of my health and well-being, but maybe I don't floss as often as I'm supposed to. But meanwhile, the dentist flosses every single day, maybe 2 times a day. I don't know what dentists do, but then they struggle with other things. That's not their profession, you know? So I think it's hard for an everyday person whose profession is not wellness to get everything right. You have to have a lot of factors working for you. But I always say that there's an opportunity that if you find that something's getting in your way, so if eating healthy at first isn't important to you and you don't see how it fits into your purpose, you might see that later. If you get a disease or a condition or you find that it's becoming an obstacle in your energy and your mood, and now it gives you a platform to make a change because it's interfering with something bigger than you, if that makes sense.
It does. Are you saying that even if we don't perfect any facet of well-being or wellness, it doesn't have to be perfect? If we can find a minimum threshold that we don't suffer in that area.
Yeah, I would say that's, you know, that's true. It all depends on what results you're looking for, you know? So I think that, you know, I often look at like maybe production lines and they have like a certain margin in which they're working in, and then they have red flags if you go below a certain threshold and above a certain threshold. But in that middle part where everything is functioning well, it's fine. And I think that you have a lot of variety that you can have within those margins. You don't have to be within the center and completely perfect with no standard deviations. Right. You can be within that. And then maybe you set up your own red flags as to what is that upper threshold or lower threshold, you know, physically or emotionally or mentally, whatever parameters you think are important to you. That's what I a lot of times talk about with people.
Nutrition is one of the facets. And what could be different facets?
It could be nutrition, exercise, sleep, mindfulness and meditation, the ability to relax, listen to your thoughts and work on those thoughts, creating more constructive thoughts, reflecting.
Is that awareness?
Yes. I mean, part of that is awareness. So you have to be aware of your thoughts to make a change. But then once you become aware of your thoughts and then you realize that perhaps you're having thoughts that aren't constructive. So everybody has a variety of thoughts, but you might have a recurring thought that you're not good enough, or every time that you make a mistake that you're a failure, a thought that really beats you up inside. That can lead to other, you know, poor behaviors, such as making poor eating decisions, believe it or not. So what you think about yourself and what you say to yourself influences how you behave. And so just changing that thought to be more kind or compassionate or empathetic, maybe similar to what you would say to somebody else. Most people don't look at somebody else that makes a mistake and says, God, you're such a failure, man. You suck. Like, people don't usually say that. And if they did, they're considered complete bullies. But we let ourselves talk to ourselves in a way we would never speak to others. And so if you are able to change your thoughts and your voice and what it's saying, it ends up influencing how you feel and how you act. Sometimes the best change you can make to nutrition is just talking to yourself in a different way. And when you do that, you end up eating differently.
Are you saying that negative self-talk can lead into so many negative things?
That's correct. A lot of people believe that if they beat themselves up, it'll cause them to perform better. You know, this notion of maybe negative reinforcement, the stick, right? If we just yell at our kids and if we just yell at our employees, it'll scare them enough, right? To do what they need to do. But we know that there are all kinds of costs that come with that. And that good behavior is really just short term or temporary. And we believe that about ourselves. If we just call ourselves, you know, fat pigs, that somehow will eat better and go exercise. But the studies just don't support that. When you don't feel good about yourself and you don't talk to yourself in a loving way, you don't do good things for yourself because you don't feel like you deserve them and that you're worthy.
Do you feel that a little bit of negative self-talk can help move the needle? It can help because it is a pain when we are going through that pain of suffering, we can move to a different level. But if that negative self-talk is constant all the time, then it is serving no purpose.
Correct. I think it has to be, you have to recognize whether you're any negativity or criticality becomes action oriented or what I would call tough love, right? So we're still tough with our kids, but we love them. It's coming from a place of love. So you can be tough on yourself and hold yourself accountable and say, you said you were going to do this, so just do it. I think that's very different than just saying, you suck, you're never going to do this, you've done it before, you always fail. That's really, really different.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So it's that notion of tough love. It's being tough and holding yourself accountable, but from a place of love instead of a place of, you know, fear or, you know, threats or something along those lines.
And when we come from a place of love, we can take action to do something about it.
That's correct. I mean, I think action is the key here. You know, if you have positive thoughts, but that you can never put them into action, right? So if you're just a dreamer and you dream of all these things, but you don't ever take action on them, positive thoughts really just sit in your brain and they don't really go anywhere, right? So I think action is definitely important. So, you know, there's no emotion that's wrong. So if you're feeling angry, but the anger leads to constructive action in some way, typically what happens is when you take constructive action, the anger begins to dissipate because you're doing something about it. And it begins to move you towards a more positive state. So I think that action and constructive action being very key is what makes the difference.
And action is the most difficult thing for a lot of people. When we take action, then breakthrough happens. Then the rubber meets the ground.
Yeah, and action probably is difficult because there's some fear behind it. You know, if you don't take action, you can always say, well, I'm like this because I didn't do that, right? I didn't try. I didn't fail. And when you take action, there's that fear that what if I take action and it doesn't go the way that I've planned, or I look silly, or I embarrass myself. There's this notion of either accountability or what others see. And so sometimes it's safer just not to do anything. And then you use that as your protection. And I see that oftentimes when I talk with people. Oh, I'm proud of my big belly. I've worked on it really, really hard all these years. That's just it's a cover up. You know, and I let them do that, but then I say, okay, so what's really going on? That's a cover up because you're scared to try. You've tried and you've had a hard time and you don't want to admit it. And so this is easier and this feels safer. And I think that's what a lot of it is. Sometimes inaction is just safety.
It could be the fear of rejection, fear of failure, or fear of judgment from others.
Absolutely.
What can we do to go from goal setter to become an action taker?
I think that, again, I always go back to purpose. You know, so there's a change process I talk about, and the first two steps are gleaming and committing. And gleaming is like when you want change to happen, but you just like want that change to happen where you like snap your finger, you know, like maybe you're on Mary Poppins, you just snap a finger and things start to happen. And you don't really want to do the work that's behind it. Whereas committing means that you want this end result and you realize it's going to be a ton of work and sacrifice and you're going to have to make change, but you're willing to do it because you have a compelling enough reason to make that happen. So that difference between gleaming and committing, I think, has to do with purpose and being inspired enough, and then also discomfort, being uncomfortable enough with the status quo that you're willing to do something about it. And so I think it's an exploration. I think it's a mistake for people to just to take action because they think they're supposed to or someone told them to, because it doesn't last very long. And then when they fail, then they think it's reflective of them and that there's a flaw within them. When I tell them, you're just a human being, either you didn't have a compelling enough reason or the status quo wasn't uncomfortable enough for you to make a change. And that's it.
Do you remember any instance from your life when you had a bigger goal, bigger vision for your life, but you were struggling with action taking?
Oh, let me think about that. I'm such an action-oriented person. You know, I think there's probably, you know, smaller examples of, you know, wanting to do well in school, let's say, but procrastinating and, you know, not doing everything that I really needed to do to get the grades that I had envisioned. And then I'd be in a panic or stress mode because I want the grade and now I've procrastinated and I'm sort of, you know, pushed into a corner and I'm like, oh my goodness, you know? So I think that there have been times where, you know, what ends up happening is you're weighing those costs and benefits. You know, it's like, I want to get a good grade, but it requires all of this effort. And I just don't know if that's completely worth it because I'm being pulled on the other side by these other things. And I think that's the other piece that we have to consider. If we're in a state of stress or worry or kind of this emotional survival state, then we engage in something called temporal discounting, which is you just look for things that are rewarding and pleasurable right here, right now, without looking at the future. And all human beings do this. And so I think that when you're in situations that you're not taking action and you have this bigger goal, what you need to do is look at what kinds of things are interfering. And I can look back in my life and recognize that I was not good at dealing with stress. I wasn't good at dealing with my emotions and personal issues that I had going on. And I think that those are the types of things that got in the way, not just of goals around school or grades sometimes. I mean, I obviously did well in school, but relationships where I struggled a lot with intimate relationships and personal relationships, I think because I hadn't dealt with some of those emotional things that were really getting in the way and causing me to engage in temporal discounting in various areas of my life.
There is always something in the gap. And you mentioned a lot of great things such as procrastination and taking too much stress, not having great intimate relationships. How do you manage stress now?
Oh man, every day, my whole entire day is really designed to help me stay on course, you know, from having routines for waking up and going to bed to I get exercise every single day. I write down the things that are priorities. And even if I don't get to anything, I shuffle and then I reschedule and put things into my calendar. I take moments to just take breaks in the day, go outside, see my kids or pet the cat, you know, little things that just re-energize me for the things that I want to get done and need to get done. We all have things that we need to do, and then we all have things that we want to do. I try to, you know, spend time with my husband and my kids and have moments that, you know, feel like, you know, we're connected. So my whole day is really designed like that. I don't like for my days to be just completely chaotic. I'm adaptable. So if something changes, I can totally adapt. But I feel like preparation, planning, organizing, prioritizing, you only have 24 hours in a day. You know, it's like if you had a small budget of money every day and then it would disappear, you know, at the end of the day, you'd probably be pretty meticulous with how you administered that money. And so that's how I feel about the time. I want to make sure that I utilize it, not just most people think about it from a work perspective, right? To be productive. I want to make sure I use it on all the facets of my life that I think make me better and make me feel good. I want to challenge myself and grow every day. I take on small challenges, things I've never done before, whatever it might be. That's also a theme in my life. And adventure. I work in adventure. I try to do that as often as possible too.
I would love to know, what challenges have you taken recently?
Well, when quarantine started, I decided to take up mountain biking. And I live in the desert in southern New Mexico. And mountain biking is not like, traveling through the forest with leaves. We're biking on rocks and through cactus plants. And so it is not forgiving, the sport. I'm almost 48 years old. This is probably not the time to take up a new sport, but it's been extremely challenging physically. It's hilly. We have mountains here from a physical perspective, emotional perspective, because you watch people crash. There's moments in which you crash. And then the mental piece, it requires a complete state of focus and attention. Complete flow is what I would call it. You cannot be distracted for a split second or you will fall into cactus needles. And so it's been great. I do like that challenge, kind of like rock climbing. I like rock climbing also. I like things that are physical, emotional, and mental all combined together at the same time. And it's been fantastic. You know, I've crashed a bunch of times, but I see the progress I'm making. I see the progress I make in my self-talk, just sometimes on the bike. Sometimes I sense myself being panicked and losing composure, and then it causes me to panic in my steering and causes poor performance. And so then I'm like, wait a second, you teach this, right? So get it together, Raquel, get your inner thoughts together. And then you start to see the shift. So I'm able to use the stuff I teach also while I'm biking.
What practices do you have in your daily life to be more self-aware? For instance, when you're biking, you have this talk that you're having poor performance, but you are more aware in a way that you can change your story to be more positive. So I would love to know, what kind of practices do you have? It could be meditation, mindfulness, so for our listeners, so that they can also implement those practices in their everyday life.
Yes. I think it's not just something that I practiced it, so I'm good at it. So I would say that therapy helped. I did a lot of therapy. And when you do therapy and you're talking, you have to become more aware of what you're thinking and what you're feeling. I did EMDR therapy, if you've ever heard of that.
Eye movement.
It's sort of like you're deconstructing your neural pathways and reconstructing them. It's a very cool therapy. But all of those things really make you much more aware of not just your thoughts, but also the emotions that are tied with those thoughts, and then what the body response is to that. So there's so many physical things that we ignore. We're sort of trained to ignore those, that a lot of the things that we are feeling and thinking start in the body, and we just ignore that. So I think in the process over the years of doing various types of therapy, you know, self-help readings, but really practices like mindfulness, you know, I've done so much mindfulness that I think that I don't have to set aside time to do mindfulness. I just naturally do mindfulness oftentimes throughout the day, which is why I tell people, like, I can't do more than one thing at once. I can't. I'm so much into the mindfulness and single tasking and meditation that I recognize that I literally cannot do more than one thing at a time. And I've done lots of meditation. I did a very intensive Silva method meditation, if you've ever heard of that. Full weekends, all day, several weekends of meditation. And I think that what ends up happening is you incorporate these sorts of practices and they start to appear in your everyday life. So mindfulness comes naturally to me. I'm constantly thinking about my thoughts. I know it sounds weird, but I literally just say, what did I just say to myself? What are the thoughts that I'm having? Could I be having a more constructive thought? Is there a better way to use my thoughts right now? You only get to have one thought at a time. That's it.
I want to ask you, which mindfulness practice has helped you the most?
I do a variety. So I do mindful walking. I do mindful eating. I do mindful breathing. Sometimes I just do mindful brushing my teeth. I mean, seriously.
Don't you think this word mindfulness is kind of burned out now?
Yeah, but it's like people think it's this thing where you're like laying, you know, down or, you know, with your legs crossed. Mindfulness is paying attention to what's going on and not transporting yourself somewhere else and multitasking and sort of taking away from the moment. So any time of the day, you can be mindful. And the more you practice it, the more that it you sort of default to it and you're just doing it. And so I did start with apps. You know, I have various apps on my phone. I teach my kids mindfulness and my kids have mindfulness books and mindfulness cards and mindfulness apps and those sorts of things. And so I think starting with exercises, whether it's through a book or an app, is a great way, especially if you have no idea what you're doing and you don't know what I'm talking about when I say you're just paying attention.
And speaking of mindfulness again, I would like to know your meditation practice. During what time of day you practice meditation?
For me, typically the best time to do it is when I first wake up, but before I get out of bed, or to do it right before bed. So I feel like there's two different functions. So when I do it before bed, I feel like it's relaxing. I feel like I'm letting go of things that happen throughout the day, you know, especially, you know, during these tough times that we're facing right now, letting go of those things. So it helps me to relax and go to sleep and maybe just integrate the things of the day in a positive and constructive way. When I do it in the morning, I feel like it really aligns me to what my purpose is and who I am and what my goals are for the day, what my priorities are, who I want to be. And I feel like it gets my day started on the right foot versus cluttering my mind with how many emails do I have and blah, 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 and all that sort of stuff. It's just not a great way to start the day. So I like to start it having that perspective and being grateful and those sorts of things.
What advice would you give to somebody who has never done meditation or find difficulty in meditation?
I think it's being patient and trying different practices and times of day. There's not exactly one right way to meditate. That's why there's so many different methods out there. I think starting small is also important. I mean, for some people who really have not practiced focus or awareness, you know, even meditating for 5 minutes could feel like an eternity. So you start small and incrementally go up from there, try different methods and don't beat yourself up. Be compassionate towards yourself, as we've been talking about, because everybody is different and you might have to find your path from a meditation perspective differently than other people.
Behavior change takes time. It doesn't happen overnight.
That's true.
And you are a busy person. How do you manage, or how do you balance, or I should say, how do you integrate so many practices in your daily life?
I think what I said, I organize, I prioritize, I schedule things. I'm pretty good at setting boundaries and planning. So even though I get up early, maybe sometimes I get up at 4 a.m. to start some of my presentations, or as I mentioned earlier, I have a client in Asia, and so I'm having evening calls. I know that ahead of time and I plan my schedule around it. So then I reschedule my exercise for a different time, but I literally write it in my calendar and block time. And if somebody asks me for a meeting during that time, I tell them I already have another meeting. They don't need to know what it is. That's my business, right? So I'm not going to let other people's urgencies get in the way of what's important to me. And I think that that's maybe one of the reasons I own my own business and I don't work for anybody anymore. I've always been that kind of person, a little bit rebellious from that perspective and sort of setting my boundaries and not necessarily giving in to what other people want of me. And that's just maybe a personality I've developed. And so if you don't have that personality, I do understand that it could be harder to do these sorts of things. But basically, if it's important to me, I schedule it in and I make sure that it happens. And I schedule a lot of things in because I like my life to be exciting and full. And I like to do so many different things. And I feel like every day is a gift and I want to do as much as I can with it, but still not live my life as if it's the last day. Because I think if you're living life as if it were the last day, you could justify being reckless and careless. So I look at each day as a gift, but hoping that I get the gift of many more. So making investments today with this gift that will continue to pay off in the future.
You seem to be a very grateful person. How do you find gratitude in this pandemic we are living in?
I think I've practiced gratitude. First of all, I want to say that everything I'm talking about, it's not like I have some natural innate anything. I mean, this is all practices. You can get good at anything you want to. And I think I've gotten better at being grateful because I was a person who struggled with being happy in the past. I was a person who struggled with my mental health and obsessive compulsive disorder and depression and things along those lines. And I needed to learn skills that would help me not struggle every single day. I don't want to just be surviving. I want to feel like I'm thriving. And so I've learned to be grateful, not just for the things that maybe we're typically grateful for, you know, our health and having a job and having health insurance or whatever that might be. I try to find gratefulness in things that don't seem like you should be grateful for on the surface. I find gratitude in, you know, the fact that I've had cancer and that I've gotten through it, and that experience makes me stronger and better and gives me a different perspective. So I'm grateful. I'm grateful that I had 6 miscarriages before having my kids and struggled so much. I didn't feel like that at the time, but I can be grateful for it now because I'm so appreciative of my kids in a way that is hard to describe. And I've been able to help other women struggling with fertility who feel alone and feel like no one understands the pain that they're in. So I try to find gratitude in my daughter having autism or Tourette syndrome. I try to find gratitude in things that maybe others might look upon and say, oh my gosh, that's terrible. Or, you know, but you learn from it, you grow from it, you become more human because of it. And so I think when you can look around and be grateful for things that are harder to be grateful for, or maybe things that are harder to think of, like clean water. You know, how hard is it for other people around the world to have clean water and sanitation? And they take a risk that they're going to go blind every time they go get water and drink. That's insane. And so I look at it and I go, how grateful am I that I don't have to worry about a lot of the things that so many people in this world have to worry about?
I love what you mentioned, that it's a practice. Even if it doesn't come naturally, if we keep doing it over and over, it becomes natural. Our subconscious mind gets trained. And this is a great advice for our listeners, that keep practicing. Even if it doesn't come naturally, we will get better at it. And our behavior change, positive behavior change, will come in weeks and months and years, definitely.
Yes.
And speaking of wellness and taking care of ourselves, how much weight do you give on sleeping?
Oh my gosh, sleeping is, it's just so critical. You know, I talk about nutrition, exercise, sleep as this kind of triangle of things that you want to do from a self-care perspective. But I think that sleep is really the foundation of those three, because when you don't get enough sleep, you're really immediately in a survival-based state. The system doesn't understand why you didn't get enough sleep. It doesn't understand that you were up late binge watching something on Netflix that you thought was really awesome. It doesn't work like that. The system says you didn't get enough sleep. There must be something wrong in your environment. Like, you were being threatened or attacked last night. You were protecting your land and your women and your food. It's sort of that primitive sort of protective mechanism. And because of that, it affects everything else, including your food and your exercise. So if you don't get enough sleep, you end up eating more food, you're not as satisfied, you store more of it as fat, your thermoregulation and metabolism changes to compensate for that lack of sleep. And most people are not getting enough sleep most nights. So they're trying to fix their nutrition or exercise, and I just say, fix your sleep and the other things will likely fall into place, or at least begin to fall into place. So sleep is so critical from a body and brain perspective, performance, wellness, well-being, mental health, diseases, conditions, you name it, dementia, sleep is critical.
Sleep is not a should, it is a must. And I feel that you are speaking to me directly for the sleep. Can I speak on sleep in my own life?
Sure.
If I don't sleep less than, or if I don't sleep more than 7 hours, I do not operate well. In the last 2 days, because of my schedule or things were happening, I couldn't get more than 7 hours of sleep. And when I don't sleep that much, then my focus goes on to more eating. I eat whatever I see.
Yes.
I'm more on social media. My focus, the ability to concentrate on things goes down, and it is all connected with the sleep in my life. If I'm sleeping more than 7 hours, I'm the happiest person in the world.
Yeah,
nobody can stop me. I'm unstoppable. Like, I can do so many big things.
And here's what I will say. You're not alone from the perspective that we all need adequate sleep. But here's the thing. You notice the difference when you sleep enough and when you don't sleep enough. You notice that you eat more. You notice that you're not as focused. Here's what happens with the majority of people who don't get enough sleep. They do it so much. They do it so long. And because many people don't practice self-awareness techniques, they don't realize that the weight that they've put on could be due to a lack of sleep or some of the issues that they've had with prioritizing and getting things done and being focused and being able to single task without distraction. They don't have enough self-awareness to realize what a lack of sleep is doing. And what they say is, oh, I only get 5 hours of sleep, 6 hours of sleep, and I'm totally fine, because the system over time makes you feel that way. It's like that homeostasis, right? The system tries to adapt to whatever it is that you're doing, and you don't have enough self-awareness to realize, you know, that it's having this effect. But Nishant, the great news is you have self-awareness, which now,
but
it's good because self-awareness leads to action. So what you're going to do is, as many nights as you can, you're going to control in making sure that you get enough sleep. And then the days that you don't, you're going to realize that you don't have good performance and then work probably even harder to make sure you get enough sleep the next night.
I was doing the podcast recording with one of the great Navy SEALs. And I asked him, how many hours did you sleep last night? Can you imagine how much?
They probably said 4.
11.
No way. See, and I get like, I used to work for the military. So you have these people that say, I only get 4, like, right? These really hardcore people. And they're like, that's all I do. And I'm hardcore, right? Or you get the people that are very self-aware and understand that even more sleep than what's recommended can give you incremental improvements in your performance. Like 11 hours.
It's the foundation.
Yeah, they've done all of these great studies on basketball players where they do sleep extension studies, meaning that they make them get even more sleep than 7 to 9 hours, like 10 hours and 11 hours. And it is associated with better performance on, you know, the free shots, free throw shots and things along those lines. So it is really interesting. Sleep extension can really help you.
You are not alone in this journey. We all struggle in life. There is no shame in talking about it. I go through my highs and lows. I get depressed. But these practices really help me in living a resilient and mindful life. You can also do this. You got this. Don't judge yourself. Why do you think high performers don't want to stop? They don't prioritize sleep.
I think they tell themselves, they have a narrative around maybe not needing sleep. They're sort of, they kind of create this superhero sort of image of like, I don't need sleep. I'm awesome. I'm immune to that, right? So they create this narrative that they are not like your average human being because they perform, maybe they outperform the average person, right? They can get so much done at high quality that they begin to create an entire narrative that they don't need to eat right. They don't need to get enough sleep. They don't need to exercise. They don't need those things. This is like that naturally they're awesome, right?
So could you recommend something to fix our sleeping problems?
Well, I think that's complicated because I think you have to explore where your sleeping issues come from. You know, I'm a big believer in getting to the root cause of problems. So I'm not a believer in just fixing things, right? So you just go and do this. You really want to do an exploration to say, is it, you know, sleep hygiene routines? Is it noise? Is it something I'm doing with electronics? Could I have a underlying medical condition or sleep apnea? So I think you want to do a little bit of self-reflection and realize what you're doing and how you're doing it, because then it can point you in the right direction of what to do differently. There's probably 40 things you could do to get better sleep, but you don't want to try all 40 at once.
Right. You try one thing. If it doesn't work, you try another thing. I would like to ask you about your cancer. How did you navigate that phase into your current phase?
Yeah, I look back, I got cervical cancer when I was about, 24, 25 years old. So pretty young. I think part of getting through it was just being naive and being young and feeling invincible. So some of what I've talked about, because, it was, drastic surgery and biopsies that followed to make sure that the cancer hadn't, the margins were clean, that the cancer hadn't come back. And I've had a few scares since then where I've had to go see oncology because they thought the cancer came back. And I can tell you that, after having kids and being in your 40s, the cancer scare, I think, takes on a more serious tone than when you're 25. So I think back then I just said, okay, this is what the doctor says I have. I need surgery and I'm just going to do it. And then I'm going to follow up the way that they said. I had already been doing a lot of therapy by then. And one of the things that I was working on in therapy was not to worry as much. I was a person that worried a lot and even had a lot of panic attacks. And the worry thoughts would consume me because they fell into my obsessive compulsive disorder. So my obsessive thoughts and worry about harm coming to me and things along those lines was very consuming. And I was very lucky that I got the cancer post a lot of intensive therapy. So I think I was able to manage those thoughts and just say, all you can do is take action. Worrying about what could happen just isn't useful. And so that came in handy to me. And then I really just tried to keep that mindset all along. So even when I've had a couple of scares and had to go see the oncologist, I just take it in stride. I use humor a lot, which some people find inappropriate. I go in and I'm like, all right, tell me if I'm going to have to shave my head bald and prepare for, chemo and I try to use a sense of humor, which, I don't think that would work for everybody. And I certainly wouldn't want to make that joke about somebody else, but that's just how I feel like it helps me to deal with things. Like when I was going through my miscarriages, having 6 lost pregnancies in a row is really not fun. And it was probably the worst time of my life, honestly, with how I felt.
I can definitely say that.
Yeah, but having a sense of humor is what helped me through it. Like I would say, yeah, I'm a baby killer. And people would be like, oh my God, that's horrible. And I'm like, I know it's hard to understand sometimes and you want to judge people for that, but making jokes like that, although they're not funny, just you have to do something because if not, the alternative is terrible, honestly.
It seems to me, and as a listener, you have gone through so many things in your life. So many disasters, I would say, and you have dealt with those things in a very loving, positive way. And it seems that you have been very resilient since you were in your 20s. Did you inherit from your parents or does it come naturally to you?
No, it does not come naturally to me. So, I think
gone through is not easy. It's so tough.
It is, but I think, there's so many people that go through tougher and they're amazing. I think that I look around and I've had role models in my life. I have friends, I have women in my life that are so incredibly strong and inspirational that they really move me. And I think to myself sometimes, if they can get through that, I can definitely get through this. That's how I try to do it, because if not, the alternative is terrible. And I think therapy has certainly helped. I think being more self-compassionate. I think that the biggest thing that I sort of held against myself for a very long time is I was date raped in college and I never reported it. So I'm one of those people, right? That that people talk about, right? And as I reflect back and I look on getting through that, I think the hardest part for me to get through that wasn't necessarily the rape, although that part was difficult. And hard. I think it was this notion of not forgiving myself for the incident, because that's sort of what we do, right? We blame ourselves in some way, but also for not reporting it. And then just, you just sort of beat yourself up. And I think that over the years, one of the things that being in this field of neuroscience and behavior change and understanding the brain, and what that has helped me to do is understand my response and understand why I felt this way and understand why I didn't report it or why I felt the things that I felt in the days that followed. And it helped me to be so much more forgiving to myself. I was able to forgive the person that did this to me much sooner than I was able to forgive myself. But I think understanding how the brain works has helped me to help myself. You know, I now understand the things that I need to do to process these things in a more healthy way, to learn from them, to grow from them. And I wouldn't take any of those things back. It's not a fun thing to go through, but you learn a lot about yourself and the world going through something like that. And then you're able to help and talk about it with other people who might be going through the same thing and may not have processed it. And so it's like the example of gratefulness. I'm grateful for all of the things I've experienced and what I've gone through because they make me who I am and what I have to offer. And so I've practiced resilience. Trust me, I am not natural. I mean, human beings are naturally somewhat resilient, but you do have to work on it. You can't just take it for granted. You have to practice.
I will come back to resilience in a while. Can I ask you something else?
Sure.
How did you forgive yourself and how did you forgive that person who raped you?
I think that first is that although I never reported it, I did confront the person later. And I was able to listen. Instead of being, I think, defensive and angry, I really wanted to listen to his point of view. And I think that that helped me to understand that human beings do things for a lot of different reasons. And there's always an ugly side to all of us. There are things that all of us have done or said in our lives that we wouldn't be proud of, that we look back and say, why did we do that? And a lot of factors play into that. And I'm not excusing what he did because what he did, you know, was awful. But I can understand the inputs that went into him. He's a human being. And it didn't help me to just keep holding on to that and being angry and all of those sorts of things. It just was harming me. So I was able to forgive, not forget. Obviously, I'm talking about it now. From time to time, I think about it. But I was able to forgive. And that has helped me to forgive other people and other things in my life, which I think is also important because forgiveness is also a practice. And when you can learn to forgive bigger things and harder things, you become better and better at forgiving people. And then you get better at forgiving yourself. The process of forgiving myself took, I would say, decades longer. It took a very, very long time. And I would beat myself up for, you know, not fighting harder or, you know, things along those lines. But when I learned about neuroscience and I learned that the most instinctive response to threat, especially when you feel like you can't do anything, is to completely be paralyzed in fear. It's more primitive than the fight or flight response and requires no chemical reaction. It's a complete shutdown of the system to go completely numb, like you would see a possum playing dead. And I had beat myself up for so long about that response. What's wrong with me? Why didn't I bite? Why didn't I scratch? Why didn't I punch? Why didn't I kick? And when I realized that I was so scared that my whole system shut down, which then reminded me of a time at when I was 13 years old that I was jumped getting off the school bus and beaten to a pulp, the same thing happened, that I completely froze, played dead as I was being bashed into the pavement. And so I connected those two things and I said, oh my gosh, I'm just a human being having a human response that has been programmed into my brain to help me to survive. How do you override that? You can't override that. That's just the response and that's it. And so accepting that and understanding that allowed me to just say, there's nothing to even forgive. You're just a human being and you can only expect human being behaviors from yourself.
It sounds simple, but it is not simple to forgive others, right? So do you think the therapy process helped you in that navigation?
I mean, I think it did for sure. I think that it helped me so much that I always look around and say, everybody should get therapy. It doesn't matter who you are and what kind of life you have and how happy you are. Therapy is very beneficial, you know, I think for a lot of reasons. Of course, I don't know anything different. I don't know what my life would have been like without therapy. So it's hard for me to compare that. And maybe it would have been the same. But all I know is that I did therapy. I found the benefits of it. I was able to incorporate practices that we did in therapy into my everyday DNA of how I operate. And so, yes, I think it was extremely helpful.
Could you suggest one practice to forgive others?
I really think that it has to do with some empathy and compassion. The way that I try to look at it is that, well, it's sort of the way I teach behavior. Behavior is simply an output that is a reflection of your internal environment. And your internal environment is memories, emotions, thoughts, and inputs coming from your external environment. A behavior is not random. So when someone behaves in a certain way, and maybe they've offended you, maybe they've insulted you, it's very hard to do. And I'm not saying I do this with everybody, but I think I do it fairly well. It's trying to understand why they have those behaviors. What are their inputs? What have been their experiences? What has been their emotions? What are the memories that they're holding? And we know that people who have experienced neglect and abuse and poverty types of conditions oftentimes create, you know, a protective mechanism within them. And so because of this protective mechanism, and they're more likely to go into survival mode for less stimuli and maybe over-respond because they're hypervigilant and also defensive, they might engage in behaviors that are survival-based. And survival-based behaviors are, you know, more negative expressed emotions, more cynicism and sarcasm and thoughts that are just critical and judgmental, but it's self-protective. So when somebody does that, I try to say, what was their childhood like that makes them respond this way or talk this way? And I try to show compassion and empathy from that perspective, because nobody's just doing this randomly to be mean. If somebody's mean, they're mean for a reason. And so try to find it. Yeah, that's what I always say. They're a product of what's happened to them in their lives and the things that have occurred and the things that they've done in response to that. And we do things out of survival, and then it becomes a habit, and then it becomes who we are. And it takes a lot of work. And the people who have been exposed to those sorts of things are probably people who have less access to help, to have interventions for those sorts of things. And it changes the entire way that your brain is formed, connected, and programmed. Your brain actually looks different than other people's brains when you've gone through those sorts of things. So I think empathy and compassion is the foundation for forgiveness.
And forgiveness is a spiritual practice.
Yes. And of course, you see it weaved through all of the different religions, this notion of forgiveness. And I think it's weaved through that because it's this notion of humanity. And we're going to need people to forgive us in our lives. And that's what I try to think about it as well. So I say, you know, I'm going to want people to forgive me for things I've said and for things I've done because I'm not perfect. So why wouldn't I grant that same thing to others? And I think that's where it weaves into religion from a humanity perspective. I don't know if you agree with that.
Do you believe in God?
Yeah, that's a tough one. You know, I believe in this higher power connection. I'm a very spiritual person, but I don't follow any specific religion. I believe in everything being connected in terms of, you know, what you put out there, you sort of put into the world and to some degree get back in some sense. And so you really want to put as much good into the world. Everything that you do has a domino effect on everything else. Whether it's people, places, or things, you know, whether it's the earth, whether it's people, doesn't matter if they're halfway around the world. We're seeing right now that there are no borders and there is no division. Everybody's connected, and what happens to a group of people ends up affecting another group of people. So that's really my belief. And so I try to put as much good into this world that I can. But I think there's a little bit of me that, I don't know, it's kind of a weird thing, this notion of why I'm not religious. I think that part of what has happened to me in my life, I feel like I need to be very self-reliant, and it's almost this, maybe a chip on my shoulder. I feel like I need to have all of these methods. I feel like I need to be the one that's aware and that manages and that sort of thing. And the self-reliance is so much that I feel like I don't want to rely on anything or anyone else.
What's the myth you see around self-reliance?
I mean, I think you always need support and help from others, right? But I think that I overdo it with self-reliance. My husband would totally agree with that. I'm like, no, don't help me. I can do it myself, right? So I have a little bit of that, I think, from my experiences in life. And it is hard for me to ask for help or admit that I need help or support. I've done it and I work on that. But I feel like that's one of the reasons that I don't become reliant, like on, I don't know, maybe any aspect of religion, because I'm like, no, I have to do it all myself. So, I mean, I can't be perfect, Nishan. I have to have a flaw, right?
So, yeah. So we have a free ground for you. If you want to ask for any help, please practice.
Thank you. Yes, I do look for opportunities to practice and do that. So I'm trying to get better at it.
Having gone through so many things in your life and the kind of great work you are doing now, what kind of relationship have you developed with your children now?
Yeah, I think for my children, I very much am in that role of, you know, listening and guiding. I try not to be too prescriptive in a sense. I know as a parent, that's really hard to do, but I really look for them to have different experiences, self-exploration. As I mentioned, you know, I do a lot of practices with the kids in terms of, you know, teaching them mindfulness and meditation and visualization and things, you know, things that they can do to be more self-reliant. My kids talk to counselors. So my daughter, who is 14, you know, talks to a counselor every week. I think it's really good for her, especially at this phase, to have somebody else to talk to and kind of get her thoughts out and her feelings and have somebody listen and maybe reflect back. And then we do some family therapy with my son, who just, you know, he's very emotional, very sensitive, and just has very big responses. And I think that it's better to start working on those things when you're younger, rather than waiting until older. I mean, I started therapy at 18, which is maybe fairly young, but I wish I'd started earlier, you know, and learned a lot of these skills at an even younger age. So I feel like I'm a good guide to my kids within reason. We have great open conversations. My kids talk to me about everything, I think. I mean, I guess I only know what I know, right? But that's what it feels like.
What makes a successful parent?
I think, you know, unconditional love is the foundation. You know, you can't have your kids feel like you only love them when they're good or behaving in certain ways. I think it needs to be unconditional love and then nurturing. And nurturing isn't just, you know, providing the basics for the kids, but you have to nurture your kids from an emotional perspective, from a mental perspective, you know, from a spiritual perspective, in terms of having them think about their purpose and who they want to be as human beings, and having them realize that, you know, who they are, what they say and what they do says more about them than anybody else, right? So, you know, what you do and what you say speaks volumes about who you are. So who do you want to be and how do you navigate your way to it? Understanding that, you know, they're going to make mistakes and they're going to, you know, say things and do things that don't make sense and align, and they have to learn from those things. So I think allowing them to do that, it's a tough balance between over controlling them, right, so that they don't get hurt and they stay safe, but letting them go out there and make mistakes and explore so that they can learn on their own as well. And I do struggle with that balance. So
there is so much thing we can discuss in this podcast, and I believe we will have to do many podcasts regarding you. So before I ask you my last question, I want to ask you, what books have inspired you the most in your life?
Oh man, I think that Man's Search for Meaning by Dr. Viktor Frankl, I think, is a must read for everybody. I think that from a neuroscience perspective, because I'm a nerd, the brain that changes itself, I think it's Norman
Foy.
Yeah, I love that book. I think it just absolutely, it's such an empowering book. So I love that one too.
And but I've never read that. I have never read that. It's been sitting in my shelf for years.
Oh my gosh, you're missing out. You have to read that book. I think that the book, I have a very nerdy book on the polyvagal theory by Dr. Porges. And that book, which is a huge textbook, I love it. This is the kind of nerdy thing that I like to read. And I mean, there's just so many books. I have books on happiness and joy, and there's just so much out there that's so great that it's hard to even narrow it down. I have a book too, but
what is the book? about
it? It's called The Business of You, and it's leveraging business principles to thrive in your life. So it's really just a reflection of a lot of the work that I've done over my life. It has some of my personal stories in there, but also stories of clients. And then I hope that it inspires people the way that other books have inspired me to better myself and to learn new things and, you know, continue this journey of growth.
I will put your book details in the show notes for sure.
Aw, thank you.
And last question, last but not the least, where can our listeners find you online?
Well, my company name is Revitalize Project. So my website is revitalizeproject.com. Revitalize Project can be found on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and Revitalize Project also has a YouTube page. And if people want to email me, it's super easy. It's Raquel, which is R-A-Q-U-E-L, at revitalizeproject.com. And I'm also on LinkedIn, Dr. Raquel Garzon, if you want to connect.
Dr. Raquel, thank you so much. It was so amazing conversation with you.
Thank you, Nishant. So this has been so great. I want to keep talking to you. So let's do it again.
Sure. Thank you for listening to this podcast episode today. If you did enjoy this, please subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, or you can visit https://nishantgarg.me. nishantgarg.me. You can also share this episode with your loved ones to help them live a fulfilled life. You are not alone in this journey. We all struggle in life. There is no shame in talking about it. I go through my highs and lows. I get depressed, and these practices help me in living a resilient life. You can also do this. You've got this. Don't judge yourself. You are doing the best you can. And thank you so much again. Any advice dispensed in this interview is purely for educational purposes. The content here should not be taken as medical or mental health advice. And because each person is so unique, please consult your healthcare professional for any related questions.